Apparently I can. Good morning. It is 10:24, Wednesday morning, July 22nd. And we're picking up today with, I don't even know what chapter. I said all the chapters yesterday and where we were going and what we were doing. And it looks like we are going into Liquids and Solids, chapter 10. Finishing up, we already finished the gas laws. We're going to skip over 9. At the moment, I couldn't tell you what 9 is, but I know that the next spot that I want to go is chapter 10. And this is solids and liquids. The main thing that I want to hit here is energy transfers, because this is an important topic as you move forward and having some idea of how energy transfers work and phase transitions work is important. And so that's the main thing that I want to get out of this chapter. And I suppose some of the questions that we'd like to know is, when we heat a solid or we heat a liquid, how does that material change temperature? How do we calculate temperature for that object? Well, the main thing that we got out of the gas laws when we were talking about the gas laws is that we said that when molecules collide, that energy is exchanged in collisions, and that temperature is proportional to the movement of the molecules themselves. And hang on one second, I got the file just finished transcribing, which means I got to find the place to save it in the appropriate place, which takes my window just a second and takes brain power away from what I was saying. So that was morning lab. Okay, brain power now diverted back to lecture. Heat is transferred through collisions. And when we look at how much heat is input to a given object and how that object changes temperature, it's different for every object. It's different for every material, based on that material's what is called specific heat. Specific heat, which is given the symbol C, is the amount of energy required to increase the temperature of 1 gram of material. By 1 degree C. And when we look at energy, we haven't talked about energy units. The units that we use for energy are two. We use a calorie and a joule. The calorie, the definition of a calorie is the amount of energy required to raise 1 gram of water by 1 degree C. That's how we measure a calorie, and that's the definition of a calorie. So a calorie, 1 calorie equals the um, the amount of energy required to raise 1 gram of water by 1 degree Celsius. That's the definition of a calorie. And a joule is an SI unit. So we think of the calorie sort of as a more of an English unit. The joule is an SI unit. And the joule, in terms of the way that the joule is defined, I can't remember the way the joule is defined, but I can tell you that that it is 4.186 joules equals 1 calorie. And so we can interconvert between calories and joules in terms of units. And there are other energy units, but in terms of chemistry, we generally work within calories, joules, and kilojoules. Those are the units that we typically use. And so these specific heat values, when I look at specific heat is the amount of energy required to raise or increase the temperature of 1 gram of material by 1 degree C. That means that when I look at C, specific heat, that specific heat, symbol C, has units of calories per gram degree Celsius, or sometimes joules per gram degree Celsius, depending upon the units and the way, which types of units, but usually calories. We could look at it both calories and joules. So water water has a specific heat. If I take a look at water specific heat, H2O, which is a liquid, has a specific heat, C, in calories per gram degree C, equal to 1.01 calories per gram degree C. If I look at copper as a metal, as a solid, copper's specific heat is 0.09197 calories per gram degree C, meaning that it takes a lot less energy to increase the temperature of copper than it does to increase the temperature of water. Why not 1.00? It's a good question. Because I'm pulling numbers from a chart that I'm looking at, and usually we go off the definition, but the definition may be based on a specific pressure, and that may change at atmospheric pressure, and so I'm not exactly certain what value they actually used in the table or where it was pulled from. Let's see if I got some other specific heats to give you here, and then we can show how we can use them. It changes the specific heat based on phase as well. So water, which is not a liquid, but water, which is a solid. So if we're looking at ice, then the specific heat of ice drops down to 0.4897 as a solid calories per gram degree C. And so the specific heat of a material is also specific to its phase. Water gas will have a different specific heat. And the gaseous water is close to the ice, actually, close to the solid, 4969 calories per gram degree C. And I have air. I wish I had some other materials. I don't have a whole lot of other materials to show you. Air, if we put it in here as a gas, which is a mixture, but in general, air has a specific heat equal to 0.2419 calories per gram degree C. So what do these all mean? What do we do? Let's look at a problem and what we might use these values for and how we might understand what the specific heat actually tells us. To change the temperature of a cup of tea, just treating it as water, from 25 degrees C to 100 degrees C would require how much energy? And we'll say, I put my question mark in there too fast. If the cup contains 300 milliliters, okay, so what we're doing is we're ignoring the cup itself and we're just looking at the 300 milliliters of water and how much energy is it going to require in order to change that temperature from 25 degrees Celsius to 100 degrees Celsius. And the way that we do these is the equation is energy equals mc delta T. That's our equation, where M equals mass in grams, where C equals the specific heat, and that's in usually calories per gram degree C, but it could be in joules, and delta T is the change in heat or the change in temperature. And it's defined as the temp final, not the absolute value, but the temp final subtract the temp initial. It's how big a change in temperature are we looking at? And so we can make a list similar to what we do to PV equals NRT and list out our mass, our specific heat, and our temperature. And our specific heat was 1.01 calories per gram degree C. This would come from a table. We don't generally memorize these. So either from table or from problem. So they are oftentimes stated in the problem if we're giving you a material that you don't know. The mass is given to us as 300 milliliters, but that's going to be problematic because mass needs to be in grams in order for this to actually work. So we'll have to convert the milliliters into grams. And the change in temperature is 100 degrees C, subtract 25 degrees C. So we've got a change in temperature, which is 75 degrees C.
Where does the 1.01 come from?
From a table or from the problem stated in the problem. So we either have to go back to the table and look it up for the specific material that we're using, or that would have been stated in the problem if we weren't given a table to look it up in. So up above, the 1.01 was for liquid water. Mm-hmm. The specific heat is 1.01 grams calories per gram degree C.
And if this kind of question is asked, a table will be provided?
Yes.
Sweet. Thank you.
Either that, or we just give you the specific heat in the problem, so you don't even have to look it up.
Okay.
All right. So the problem here, though, before I can tackle this, is that this guy needs to be converted into grams. So I need to go from milliliters to grams. Remember what grams per milliliter was? Remember densities? density equals grams per milliliter, mass divided by volume, and the density of water was a value that I wanted you guys to memorize a long time ago. 1 gram per milliliter, yeah. And in fact, we just memorized it as 1.00 grams per milliliter, which means that for every 1 milliliter, I'm getting 1.00 grams. So this 300 milliliters equals 300 grams. Good job, Devin. Eric wants to know when we use E equals MC squared. Not until physics. Actually, that's not true. You can use E equals MC squared in certain areas in chemistry when you're doing electron configurations and calculating energy and mass differences for different particles and things. So E equals MC squared, we kind of bypass that. There's not very many places where we actually use that in chemistry until much, much later in curriculums. Okay, so we've got everything that we need here, and we say that energy equals mass times specific heat times delta T, and all we do now is plug in the values, 300, I think I'm working in the wrong color. grams to 3 sig figs times 1.01 calories per gram degree C times the change in temperature of 75 degrees C. And when I go through and I look at units, grams cancel grams in the denominator. Degree C cancels degree C in the denominator, and I'm left with units of energy, calories. So this problem becomes 300 times 1.01 times 75, and it tells me that it requires something crazy because my calculator was not cleared and had other stuff in it. 300 times 1.01 times 75, 22725 calories. Now we go through and we figure out sig figs. It was 3, 3, and 2. So 2 is our smallest. The amount of energy is 23,000 calories, or this could be written 2.3 times 10 to the fourth calories. Or another way to write this is that this is 23 kilocalories, where a kilo is 10 to the third. And so I can convert this by moving the decimal place over 1, 2, 3, 23. That would be 23 times 10 to the third, or 23 kilocalories. So I could write it in multiple different ways. All three answers would be acceptable if units weren't asked for. And Devin, yes, normal nutritional measurements are in kilocalories, which is something that we usually cover in Chem 30B in the medicinal chemistry class more than we cover in here. But you're absolutely right. When you look at a calorie, there are two different types of calories. There is a calorie which is a lowercase c. This is what we are defining as one calorie with a lowercase c is equal to 4.186 joules. And then we have something that is a calorie with a capital C, which is what we call a food calorie. And a food calorie is equal to 1 kilocalorie or 1,000 calories.
Wait, so when you're like, oh, this nutrition bar has 100 calories, it's really what, 100,000 calories?
Yep.
Absolutely. Really?
That's really true.
Crazy.
Yeah, because they figured they would freak out people, right? And so if people were eating calories and they figured that they were eating a nutritional bar that it had 23 calories in it and it was 23,000 calories, 23,000 sounds like an enormous number. And the general public, who is not scientific at all, would completely freak out. And so they decided to make a food calorie, which was 1,000 calories, a kilocalorie. And so they could have used kilocalories. Sure, they could have done that, Eric, but then the regular scientific, unscientific literate people would say that's still kilo, that doesn't sit right. So people freak out. But yes, a food calorie is 1,000 calories. And the only difference in the way that we write the units is a lowercase c versus a capital C.
And then you get on the treadmill and you're only burning regular calories, not kilocalories?
No, on the treadmill, you're still burning kilocalories. So they still match up. You're still burning food calories when you do that.
Depends on who made the treadmill, though.
That's true. It depends on whether or not it's a scientific treadmill measuring actual calories versus measuring food calories. Talk about confusion. There's enough confusion there. That was Devin. Thanks, Devin. That is helpful and spot on for calories and the difference between a food calorie versus an actual chemical calorie. All right. With those changes in temperature, one of the things that we like to look at is phase changes. And so the temperature calculations for how hot something gets or how much energy it takes, or even calculating the specific heat of a material. I should maybe talk about how we calculate specific heat. How do we actually calculate specific heat? Is done with an object called a calorimeter. What we do is we take a device that is set and surrounded by water, and we put the object that we want to combust, whether it be food or whatever, the material to measure. And outside of this device is a large amount of water. And this water acts like a reservoir and a heat sink. And inside of this, we place a thermometer that allows us to measure the temperature. And what we do is we weigh the material, so we get the material's mass. Let's say that whatever that we're combusting here is maybe 100 grams of, I need a material and I have no idea what material I want to use. Let's say it's like, I don't know. I don't even need to give it as a material. It's just 100 grams of material that's in there. And what we do is we take the initial temperature of the water. And then we take the final temp after we combust the material. And then we, and actually maybe if I want to make this clear, what I could do is I could say we take the initial temp of the water, and then we combust the material. And then we take the final temp of the water after we do the combustion so that we can get delta T and we can figure out how much the water changed in temperature. So that the delta T equals the change in temp for the water. And all the energy that went into that, the energy came from the combustion of this material. Once we do that, we know how much energy now came out of this because we know the specific heat of water, so we can calculate the amount of energy for the change based on the heat of water. We can then tell how much energy was contained within that material from its combustion. And this device is called a calorimeter, a bomb calorimeter, essentially. So that's a bomb calorimeter. Like if we want to measure a food and we want to tell how many calories are in the food, we take the food, we throw the food in here, we throw the hamburger, the french fries, whatever it is for the meal that we want to figure out how many calories are in that food. We combust it, we burn it, we release all the energy. When the energy is released, that energy is absorbed by the water. The change in temperature of the water using MC delta T then tells us how much energy went in to change the temperature of this water. And then we can back calculate how much energy came out of the food and was in the 100 grams of food. So that's one way that we do it. The other way that we do it in the lab, when we want to measure the specific heat of an object, is we look at another type of calorimeter, a coffee cup calorimeter. In this case, what we do is we take two coffee cups and we nest them. So we bring the two cups together and we use styrofoam coffee cups. When the coffee cups are nested, they insulate each other a little bit better. We put a specific amount of water inside it. Maybe 100 milliliters. But it would be measured accurately. So we measure the mass of how much of that water we put in. And then what we do is we put a tight-fitting lid on this to seal the whole thing up. And through that lid, we insert a thermometer so that we can measure the temperature change of this water. And then we also put into this, usually, a loop that goes around the thermometer that acts as a stirring rod. And then what we do is we take several measurements. We take the measurement of the mass of water. We take the temperature, the initial temperature of the water. We then add some material. That has a known temperature. For instance, we take a piece of metal that has been heated up to maybe 70 or 80 degrees. So we add some material like a block of metal. Of known mass. And temp. When we add that in, we then watch the temperature of the water until the temperature stops moving. We allow the system to come to equilibrium. Basically, when the temp stops falling or rising. Then we measure the final temp. Of the water. With all of those measurements, what we can do is we can then back calculate what the specific heat of that object was that we put in. We know the mass of the water. We know the temperature change of the water. We know the amount of energy that the water absorbed. That is equal to the amount of energy that the object lost. And through that, we can set those two equal to each other, and we can actually calculate the specific heat of the object, even though we didn't know it. And it's going through and just using these principles of MC energy equals MC delta T. So that's where we get these specific heats, is we get these specific heats through experiments like this, where we have an object, water, that we know the specific heat of, and another object that we don't. And then we go through and we do an experiment like this. I'm not going to have you do experiments like that, but you do in Chem 1A, and that's where you move to in Chem 1A. From here, I just wanted to give you an idea of where these measurements are coming from and how we're telling what the specific heat of these different objects are, that they're all measured using calorimetry in this way, generally using water as a measuring tool. What's more important to me than these measurements is understanding energy in phase changes, which is sort of the next thing that I want to show you. And the phase changes are really important. How materials move from one phase to another and why they do. What happens when we move from solid to liquid or liquid to gas? Or back and forth, back from gas to liquid or from liquid to solid. These are what we call phase changes. And in order to go through a phase change, what has to happen is, if we look at a solid, the particles in a solid are held tightly together by what are called attractive forces. We call them IMFs, intermolecular attractive forces. And those intermolecular attractive forces help to hold the object together. In order to be able to convert it into a liquid, where I have free movement and range of movement of the particles, now being able to flow throughout the volume, I have to overwhelm the attractive forces. I have to pull the particles apart and basically overwhelm the attractive forces to give them the freedom of movement that they would get within a liquid. In other words, what I have to do is I have to break attractive forces. That costs energy. Breaking a bond costs energy. In the same way that when I go from a liquid to a gas, and now the particles of a gas are free of the container and can move through space, I need to then again break bonds, break attractive forces, and that costs energy.
What happens if you turn a liquid into a gas inside of a sealed chamber?
Usually the sealed chamber, the pressure goes up enormously, and if the sealed chamber can't hold it, then you get an explosion. That's essentially what a pipe bomb is. A pipe bomb is where you take solid materials in a closed pipe and you mix those materials such that they release a gas. The gas builds the pressure enormously such that the pipe can't handle it, and the pipe explodes, creating metal shrapnel, that's a bomb. That's what we call a bomb. Yeah. Okay, so these phases, these changes in phase, when we look at an energy phase diagram, and we're going to look at just a general one. What we plot is we plot temperature on the y-axis, and on the x-axis, we plot energy. Then we have the different phases, such as solids, which can change temperature. As I add energy in, the material will increase in temperature. That makes sense. What doesn't make sense initially is the phase change. The phase change occurs, so this is, in this case, melting. And this is the phase change. And then we go to a liquid, which can increase in temperature. And at some point, it hits its boiling point and it goes through a phase change. And this is what we call boiling. And then it goes to a gas and it can increase in temperature again. And so we go through these different phases. The interesting part is that when I change phase, the temperature of the system doesn't change. There is no change in temperature during phase change. It costs you energy. We're still increasing in energy. If we look at the energy graph, we're going up in energy while we're melting. We're going up in energy while we're boiling. It costs energy to do those things, but there's no temperature change of the system while I am increasing energy and going through that phase change. Why is that? Because all the energy is going into breaking those intermolecular attractive forces.
Question.
Yes.
So you're saying there's no temperature during phase change, but when it's solid and it's liquid, it's going up. So does the temperature increase there and then not change when it's melting and boiling?
Yes. Think about when you boil water. If you take and you put a thermometer in water and you boil water on your stove, the water boils at 100 degrees C. As long as the water is boiling, the water is 100 degrees C. Water will continue to boil and disappear, but the water never gets hotter than 100 degrees C. You can't make water hotter than 100 degrees C at one atmosphere because that's its boiling point. And all the energy is going into breaking the bonds and converting it into steam.
Yes.
So steam is a lot hotter, which is why you can get steam burns so bad, huh?
Not exactly.
Oh, really?
Steam can be 100 degrees and water can be 100 degrees, and yet steam will burn you more because steam contains more energy, not that it is hotter. They are the same temp.
How does that work?
That's what we're going to explain. That's where we're getting to.
That's what you're talking about with the molecules, because they're moving faster when they're gas, then they slow down when they're liquid, they slow more when they're solid.
That's true. Yes, they're moving faster when they're gas and they slow down. And in the slowing down, they release energy as they slow down. Go ahead.
Doesn't liquid happen at the same time as it's melting and gas at the same time that it's boiling, though?
Yes, it does. They all coexist at the same time. So they coexist at the same time so that as a solid is melting and becoming a liquid, both solid and liquid coexist at the same time as the phase transition is going on, which means that they are at the exact same temperature at that same time.
What about the phase change?
The phase
just stays the same, but shouldn't it be increasing at the same time then?
You would think so, but it doesn't. It doesn't. All of the energy goes into breaking of the chemical bonds, the intermolecular attractive forces. And so if you think about taking and pulling two magnets apart, I need to exert energy to pull the two magnets apart. That's the energy that it costs to go through the phase change. So back to Jeremy's question, why do I get a better burn or a bigger burn from steam? And combining that with Vanessa's, that when water is boiling, steam and water are there at the same time. Both are 100 degrees C. If I get the boiling water on my hand, it hurts. But if I get the steam on my hand, even though it's at 100 degrees C, the steam hurts a lot more. The steam gives me a bigger burn. Why is that? Because the steam is imparting 100 degrees C from its temperature, but the steam also condenses back into water and releases all of the energy from making the chemical bonds. When you make a chemical bond, you release energy as well. So what we can do is we can do a comparison of exactly those two things, but we need to understand how we calculate and measure these phase changes. So at each one of these, solid, liquid to gas, I'm calculating energy, which is equal to mc delta T. So each one of these has a mass, specific heat, and delta T for its change in energy. And this is the specific heat of the solid. This would be mc specific heat of the liquid. And this would be mc of the gas times delta T for the change in temperature. The melting and the boiling, because there is no change in temperature, these are called heat of fusion and heat of vaporization. And the energy is calculated by the mass times the heat of fusion and the mass times the heat of vaporization, and there is no change in temperature. So the units for the heat of vaporization and the units for the heat of fusion are different. H of F equals heat of fusion. And it has, for water, where is it? Heat of fusion is like 79.7.
Are you talking about the fusion of gas molecules fusing into liquid molecules?
Yes. Or the solid going into liquid. So either the liquid fusing going into solid, or we can think of the solid going into liquid. It's still the heat of fusion. It's just running in different directions. Heat of vaporization . These are for water. Each material is going to have its own values. So you need to be given their own values. It's 540 calories per gram.
I thought that heat equals speed.
Heat does equal speed. No, not heat. Temperature equals speed.
Oh. But heat can also be energy, which is different than temperature.
That's right. Heat and temperature are different. So the difference between heat and temperature. Heat versus temp. Heat is the amount of energy that a particle has. So when we look at heat.
I hear patitas.
Patitas. It's the amount of energy. Hang on 1 second. Okay, there we go. Heat is the amount of energy that is in the system . It's the sum of each particle times how much energy that particle has. So when we think about heat, we think about taking all of the particles in what's called a Boltzmann distribution. And this is a graph that gives me percent of molecules and energy. And the heat is all of this. It's the area under the curve. Temp is the average. I take all the particles and I add them up and I get the heat. And then what I do is I take the heat and divide by the number of particles to see what an average particle has. That's what temperature is. So temperature is an average, whereas heat is the sum. I think we did this little example before where I took a pot of water that was like a big pot of water and I put a flame underneath it. And then I took a little tiny cup of water and I put a flame underneath it. And the flame is the same hot size, so basically energy is going in at the same rate. And if energy is going in at the same rate, we intuitively know that this one is going to boil first. This one boiling first hit 100 degrees C a lot faster than this one did, right? So in terms of what's going on here, this one boils first, but when they both boil, if this one is boiling, this one's going to boil much later. But it will also be at 100 degrees C when it boils. So they'll both be at the same temperature, 100 degrees C, but a lot more energy had to go into this one. A lot more heat had to go into this one because heat is the sum, whereas temperature is the average. So they can both be at the same temperature because the particles all average out to 100 degrees C. But the amount of heat that is contained in the small cup versus the large cup is very different. Does that sort of help with those concepts, Jeremy? And kind of.
Yeah, it's all new to me. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So let me see. What time is it? Yes, I have time for this example. Let's do this. I don't think I have this question written out, but I can do it in my head. Let's say that this goes to the burn question. Then we can do some more chemical type questions after this. After the break, we can come back and do some chemical questions. But if you spill, let's say 1 milliliter of water, on your hand, and that water started at 100 degrees Celsius to 3 sig figs. If the water cooled to 25 degrees Celsius, how many calories were released to your hand? Basically, how much energy did your hand absorb to become burned? Some of the things that you need is that the specific heat of liquid water equals 1.01 calories per gram degree C. And the density of water equals 1.00 gram per milliliter. Roadmap for solving the problem. It's a little bit complicated, but we're going to go from the milliliters of water to the grams of water. And once we get to grams of water, we're going to go through the equation, which is mc delta t equals energy, and we will come out with calories released. So that's sort of the roadmap in which we're going to follow this. And I said 1 mil of water. Let's give it a 3 sig fig 1 mil so that it's just a little bit, we've got a little bit bigger number here to deal with. So
do we do anything with the temperatures? Because those aren't listed in the
They're roadmap. In the delta T.
Oh, okay, cool.
So yes, we absolutely do, because they're going to be in the delta T. So, and we can actually think of this piece right here as being the mass part. So I could actually do this and think of it in this roadmap, that I could take 1.00 milliliters of water times, for every 1 milliliter of water, it's 1.00 grams of water. So there's my mass, times my specific heat of 1.01 calories per gram degree C, times my change in temperature, which is 100 degrees C minus 25 degrees C. And so I've got everything put into one equation. This is going to be 1. This is going to be 75 and 1.01. So really it's 1.01 times 75. So it's just a little bit more than 75 calories that are going to get released to my hand. 1.01 times 75. 75.75 calories released to the hand. Sig figs, if we go through it, this was 3, this part was 3, and this part, when I did subtraction, came down to 2. So really, it's 76 calories to 2 sig figs. And that's how much energy got released. So for 1 mil of water, your hand absorbed 76 calories.
Why was the last one 2 sig figs?
Because 100 subtract 25 is 75.
Okay.
And 75 has 2 sig figs.
I was just looking at, yes. Yes, thank you.
Okay, let's change this problem and let's look at what happens if it's steam and the same amount of steam at 100 degrees. So essentially what we did is we calculated this. We were at water at 100 degrees and we came down to 25 degrees down here. And so what we did is we calculated this amount of energy. This was the energy that was the 76 calories for the 1 gram and the change in temperature for that 1 gram of water that contacted us. Does that help to visually see that we went through a change in temperature that was 75 degree change in temperature, and that corresponded to my 76 calories? Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to change the problem and say, what if it were steam? And we'll say steam at 100 degrees C that contacted your hand. and cooled to the same 25 degrees Celsius. How much energy then would be released? Okay, visually, I want to visually compare this problem before we solve it. This is the visual comparison. You're starting off at 100 degrees C. You're going to 25. But you're starting over here at steam. You're getting all of this energy plus this energy. This is the amount of energy that we're going to calculate. It is the change in temperature for the water and the phase transition for the steam to condense. And that's the amount of energy that we're about to calculate. Let's see what that amount of energy actually looks like. So keeping that problem there, what I'm going to have to do is this is mass times heat of vaporization. And this one is mc delta T. So what I need to do is energy is going to equal mc for the liquid, delta T, plus the mass times the heat of vaporization. And that's how much energy is about to be released. I can make this equation a little bit nicer because I can pull M out and I can consolidate it. But I think I'm just going to leave it where it is. And we said that it was 1.00 milliliters. That 1 milliliter of water times, for every 1 milliliter, I got 1.00 grams. So there was my mass times my specific heat that was 1.01 calories per gram degree C times my change in temperature, which was 75 degrees Celsius. So there's the first part. The second part, which I need to add to this now, is the same mass, 1.00 milliliters times 1 milliliter for every 1.00 gram. But then I also need to multiply this by the heat of vaporization, which I said was 540 calories per gram.
Wait, where did 75 degrees Celsius come from?
Change in temperature from 100 to 25.
Oh, got it, got it.
So I'm doing this same calculation that I did here. I'm doing this same thing because I'm catching that part from 100 to 25. I'm still going 100 to 25 because I'm cooling down to 25 degrees C on my hand, but it's also going through the phase shift. And I'm getting all of that phase transfer energy.
Yes.
So this now equals, calculator, 1.01 times 75 plus 540. This is 615. 0.75 calories. And sig figs wise, we were at 2 sig figs for this part, but we're going through addition and we're adding this up. So we were at the ones place. I think we're still at the ones place. I think we're at 3 sig figs now. I think this is 615 calories. But compare those values. 76 calories versus 615 calories.
Why wouldn't it be 616?
Oh, it would be. Thank you. I get too excited about the next thing that I'm about to compare, and I jump ahead. So it's actually almost 10 times the amount of energy that's in the phase transition.
So to go back to the visual, so the initial calculation that we did was, don't tell me, was the liquid?
Yep.
Okay, and then the second calculation, and when it's at liquid, it is increasing in temperature?
A liquid can increase or decrease in temperature. So liquids can change temperature, but the phase change occurs at a constant temperature.
So are we measuring temperature or phase change?
You're not measuring temperature or phase change. You're measuring energy, which is a combination of temperature change and phase change.
Yes, we are measuring energy. I see that now.
Okay.
So we did our first calculation, which was the energy of the thing at when it was a liquid.
Just the water cooling down.
Okay.
The and liquid then, cooling down.
And then the second calculation was the
steam.
Yeah.
Condensing into a liquid and then the liquid cooling down.
Oh, we're moving to the left, not to the right.
Yeah, we're going from steam to liquid.
Okay.
And then we're cooling that liquid down and we're seeing how much energy was released in that process.
Okay. Thank you. I see. Yes.
I have a question.
Yep.
Towards the beginning, when you wrote down like the different values for specific heat for water in gas state, you said it was 0.49. 69 calories per gram?
Yes.
Why don't we use that?
Because we were actually looking at cooling down of the liquid water, not the gaseous water. So if we want to go from gas at a specific temperature down to the phase change, we would use that specific heat for the gas. Then we would go through the heat of vaporization. Then we would go through the liquid water specific heat. And then if we were going to ice, we'd even go one step further. Let's take a break. I'll come back and I'll show you. We'll do a calculation where we take ice and we'll see how much energy it takes to convert that ice all the way into steam at a specific temperature. And we'll see how we add it all together and how all three of those different specific heats come into play.
Okay. Just a quick question. Isn't steam gas though? Like, isn't it kind of?
It is, but we didn't change temperature for the gas. So the gas, we said the gas was at 100 degrees. If the gas was at 101 or 102, I'd have to cool it to 100 before it could go through the phase transition. But because the gas was right at the phase transition, there was no cooling of the gas. The gas simply slipped into phase transition without cooling.
Okay.
So I didn't have to worry about that specific heat.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'll try to make it more clear after the break. What's the other question, Jeremy?
Well, she wants Winnie the Pooh. But you had mentioned that yesterday that we were going to talk about, and I don't think it was specifically about like the process of sweating and cooling the body, but I'm curious as to if we're going to go the other direction as far as cooling, and kind of touch on that.
We could look at how much cooling. So let's say that you sweat out 100 milliliters worth of water through exercising throughout the day. How much energy was actually released in that sweating? We could do that calculation because it would be the phase transition of the water. And we would need a little bit more information. We would need to know sort of what temperature the water started at. And it's a little bit different because you're evaporating rather than boiling. But we could come up with a ballpark. We could come up with an estimate for how much energy is released.
Can you quickly explain the difference between evaporating and boiling?
Sure. Evaporating is a process where if we look at evaporation, Evaporation happens when we have an open container or like a puddle on the ground, and there is an equilibrium between condensation and evaporation. And in the open system, this is based on temperature. So factors that affect it are temp, surface area, and pressure. And what we get, go ahead.
So evaporation occurs more quickly or slowly at higher altitude because of pressure.
Faster at higher altitude. Because what happens is the pressure total, the pressure of the atmosphere, is equal to the pressure of the water plus the pressure of other gases. And as the pressure of the atmosphere goes down, the pressure of the water is really a factor of the surface area and the temperature, and it doesn't change so much. And so evaporation happens a lot faster because your vapor pressure is essentially higher.
So boiling happens slower, but evaporation happens faster.
Not that boiling happens slower. Boiling is when...
It requires more energy?
Yes, requires more energy. Boiling is where the pressure of the water is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere. And it is a rapid process of evaporation. It is a process where gas bubbles are allowed to form inside the container and to explode out explosively. This is what we call boiling. They're the same phenomenon, except evaporation happens when the pressure of the water is less than the atmosphere. Boiling happens when the pressure of the water is equal to the atmosphere. And if the pressure of the water becomes greater than the atmosphere, you get what's called explosive boiling. You get what's called bumping, where literally everything that's in here explodes out and just goes through rapid evaporation. And it's something that we actually need to be really careful of in the lab, because we can superheat lots of liquids. Many, many liquids will superheat above their boiling point, and the second you touch them or perturb the system, they explode. And so you can have like a vessel of ethanol or toluene, and you can have it heated 10, 15 degrees above its boiling point. It's showing no signs of boiling, and you go to dip a pipette in it, and all of a sudden it just blows up in your face. It just erupts into boiling because the vapor pressure was higher than the actual atmospheric pressure. But boiling and evaporating are the same phenomenon, just at different rates.
And why does evaporation occur if it's not being heated? Like, what is it about the molecules that are moving in the water that are suddenly like released into the air?
Oh my God, such good questions.
Sorry.
In a liquid, we have particles that are moving all around all the time, and they're moving in all different directions. They have attractive forces between these particles. In order for a particle to evaporate, three things must happen. The particle must be on the surface. The particle must receive enough energy from collisions to break free of the attractive forces of the liquid itself. So it takes multiple collisions. To impart enough energy. And then that particle can evaporate and become a gas particle. That happens all the time for any liquid. And the measure of how fast that happens is a measure of the vapor pressure over a liquid. So that we can measure the vapor pressure over a liquid, and the vapor pressure tells us the rate or the extent of evaporation. The vapor pressure, the pressure of the vapor, is proportional to the attractive forces. Actually, inversely proportional, I should say. meaning the stronger the attractive forces, the lower the vapor pressure. The weaker the attractive forces, the higher the vapor pressure. That's why water evaporates so slowly, because water has very strong intermolecular attractive forces, hydrogen bonding, versus gasoline, which evaporates very quickly, because gasoline is nonpolar, and the nonpolar nature of it means that it has dipole-dipole forces, and those are much weaker forces. It takes much less energy to pull those forces apart, much faster evaporation, much greater rate of evaporation.
So the reason that solids don't evaporate is because there's just not enough force to expel.
The attractive forces are too strong within a solid, although many solids do have vapor pressures. So any solid which you can smell, think mothballs, right? When you take a mothball and you take a mothball out and you can smell it, you're only smelling it because the molecule is traveling to your nose. That means there's a vapor pressure. That means that mothball is evaporating as time goes on, and you're smelling it through its vapor pressure. So if you can smell it, it has a vapor pressure. Salt, that's why you can't smell salt. Salt, the boiling point of salt, the conversion of salt into a liquid is like 1500 degrees or something. The melting point is so high that salt essentially has zero vapor pressure, and you can't smell salt. Salt has no smell to it, because it's an ionic compound with really strong intermolecular attractive forces.
So what's going on?
What's going on with what? What have you got there, Annalise? She's getting Winnie the Pooh. Somebody's been drawing Winnie the Pooh for you. You got to pin that video. Beautiful, I love it. Hanging on the balloon.
Thank you, That's Annalise. Perfect.
That's awesome. Somebody was busy during our break. All right. I don't know. We've probably been talking for 10 minutes. Everybody probably just kept tuned in. I don't know if everybody's back yet. Did we catch Kerrigan? Did Kerrigan come back? Annalise is there now. Eric, I don't know if Eric took a break or not, but I'm good. I'm good to keep going. Roxanne needs two more minutes. We'll give it another minute. We'll let people catch up for another minute, and then we'll start with some more. I know what I can do. I can write out a problem while we're waiting, because I know what I want to do. I want to catch Vanessa's question.
Jason, so when we are moving to the right on that graph and like a substance is getting hotter, you can do that by increasing the temperature, but is there a way to do that by just adding energy and not necessarily using heat?
They're one and the same, so that as you add energy, the temperature of the system does go up. So you can't add energy without increasing temperature unless you're right at a phase change.
But you don't necessarily have to use heat for it to create a phase change, right? Which is why is that like what a microwave does?
What a microwave does is the microwave energy, when we look at the microwave energy that travels as a wave, the energy associated with that is exactly appropriate for the vibrational frequency of water. So if we look at water and we think about this thing as a molecule that can scissor and can spin, the energy of the microwave is picked up by that, and it increases both the vibrational and rotational frequency of the water molecule. And the water is acting like a harmonic oscillator, picking up the frequency of the microwave. When the water molecule starts to move faster, the water molecule has increased in heat and transmits that heat through collisions to other parts of the food and other parts of the things that you're heating up. That's why a ceramic plate that has no water in it, that has been truly fired and all the water has been evaporated out of the ceramic plate, if there's no water in the ceramic, it is safe to put in the microwave and will not heat up itself. But anything that contains water in it will be affected by the microwave and will be heated. So yes.
Wait, and so does that also explain partially why metal will spark in a microwave?
Sort of. The sparking is an effect that is called it has a particular effect. And what is happening there is the microwave energy, when it hits the surface of the metal, essentially, if we take sort of like a molecular view of what's going on there and blow it up, and we look at a single atom, and here's our nucleus and the electron cloud, the energy is being absorbed by the electron and it's pinging the electron off. The electron is releasing from it because the electron has absorbed so much energy that it will release that electron. And we see that as a spark, essentially, of that thing kicking out. And so I can't remember the name of the effect. It's an electron something effect. The microwave energy is tuned not only to the vibrational frequency of a water molecule, but also to the energy of the valence electron of a metal. And it winds up kicking that metal off. So that's what that is about.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So both things wind up happening. So that's number one, why you don't put metal in a microwave. And number two, why a microwave heats up food is because of water molecules. Okay, how much energy is required to convert a block of ice weighing 200 grams to 3 sig figs, weighing 200 grams from minus 10 degrees Celsius to steam at 110 degrees Celsius. When I start to do these problems, so this addresses Vanessa's problem. When I start to do these problems, what I like to do is I like to do them visually to understand what it is I'm about to try to do. So we have the solid melting, the liquid boiling, the gas heating, and this is my energy. And this is my temp. Okay, so on my temp, I'm going from down here. I'm starting at minus 10 degrees Celsius. I'm going to go to the point here where I get to 0 degrees Celsius, and I'm going to go through melting. And then I'm going to go from 0 up to 100 degrees Celsius. And I'll hit boiling. And then at some point, I'm going to come up here. And I'm going to hit 110. And that's where I'm going to stop. I need to calculate this much energy. This constitutes my energy change that I'm looking to calculate. And as I go to calculate that, it's going to be broken up into 3, 4, 5 separate calculations. So the separate calculations that I have is I have a delta T for the ice. I have a delta T for the liquid. I have a delta T for the gas. And then I have the heat of fusion and the heat of vaporization. So all said, I'm going to have my energy be equal to M specific heat solid times the change in temperature for the solid. Add that to the mass times the heat of fusion. Add that to the mass and the specific heat of the liquid times the change in temperature for the liquid, plus the mass times the heat of vaporization, plus the mass times the specific heat of the gas times the change in temperature for the gas. All of that, five different parts, constitute the change in energy for the overall system. The values that I'm going to need to accomplish that is I'll need my specific heats and my heat of fusions for each one of those pieces. The specific heat for the liquid equaled 1.01 grams calories per gram degree C. I was about to use the wrong units. The specific heat for the gas for water I had listed at 0.4969 calories per gram degree C. And the specific heat for the solid water was equal to 0.4897 calories per gram degree C. My heat of fusion was 79.7 calories per gram. And my heat of vaporization equaled 540 calories per gram. So now I have all the information, but I do need to be careful about these delta T's. They're not all the same. The delta T's are different depending upon whether I'm in the ice, the liquid, or the gas. So from minus 10 to zero, that's a 10 degree change. From zero to 100, that's a 100 degree change. And from 100 to 110, that's another 10 degree change. So all said, as I start to walk through and build this problem is going to equal, and the mass, there's one way that I could simplify this. I could pull this mass out, pull the mass all the way out to the left and factor it out. I'm gonna leave it alone as it is because we've got 200 grams. So this is gonna equal 200 grams with a decimal point times the specific heat of the solid, 0.4897. Those are calories per gram degree C times 10 degrees C for my change in temperature, plus the mass of 200 grams times the heat of fusion, which was 79.7 calories per gram. Plus, next I'm at the liquid. So this is 200 grams times the specific heat, 1.01 calories per gram degree C, times 100 degrees C change. Plus, I need to drop down to the next line, 200 grams times 540 calories per gram for the heat of vaporization, plus 200 grams times the specific heat for the gas, 0.4969 calories per gram degree C, times a change in temperature of 10 degrees C. That's the whole calculation. So we just need to be careful as we go through and do it. 200 times 0.4897 times 10 plus 200 times 79.7 plus 200 times 1.01 times 100 plus 200 times 540 plus 200 times 0.4969 times 10. That is 146113.2 calories for that whole change. And going back and tracking sig figs is ugly. Two sig figs there. This one's going to have three. But as it's at three, that one is probably going to be my most limiting out of everything. I'm thinking it's either that one or 200. What's 200 times 540? Yeah, my sig fig is here. I wouldn't get too crazy on the sig figs on this one. But this comes out to 146,000 calories, which is equal to 1.46 times 10 to the fifth calories.
If you got two significant figures on the 10 degrees Celsius, why did you choose three significant figures?
Ah, I knew. See, I knew it. I just, okay. Let me take each piece and treat them as five different pieces. If I treat them as five different pieces, and then we go through the sig figs after this, each one of these pieces is being added together. So I'm taking all of these and I'm summing them together. So I'll be a little careful about the way that I write them, but 200 times 0.4897 times 10. This piece is 979.4 calories. And sig figs wise, as I'm tracking it, I had two sig figs in the 10 value. So I get to keep out here to that place value, to the tens place. 200 times 0.4969 times 10. This piece equals 993 calories, 93.8 calories. And likewise, it has two sig figs and I am good to my tens place. So I'm good on both of these to the tens position. The next one, 200 times 540. This was good to three sig figs, but this value is 108,000 point whatever, how many zeros. Actually, if it's sig figs, I can't keep those. I'm good out to that position for three sig figs. So now I'm at the thousands position. Next one, 200 times 79.7. I am...
Didn't you say that was 108.000?
It was 108,000, not point. It's 108,000.
Okay, cool.
The next one is 15,940. And there, my sig fig was at 3. So I am in the hundreds position on that one. And the last one, 200 times 1.01 times 100, which is going to have 3 sig figs, is 20200, 20,200. And so that one is good to 3 sig figs. And as I've marked all the sig figs now, the rounding location happens at this position, which is the thousandths position. So I add all those numbers together and I get 146113, 146113.2. I'll just do it at that, and I'm rounding here. That's what gives me my 146,000 calories, or 1.46 times 10 to the fifth calories, or I could write it in terms of kilocalories. I could say that's 146 kilocalories.
And that's just because there's addition like outside of the parentheses?
Yep. It's applying the different rules of addition versus subtraction. And yeah, it's always those different rules. It's the addition versus multiplication, or the multiplication division versus addition and subtraction. And it's always those two rules of they need to be applied in order of operation in order to figure out what the sig figs are. And the sig figs, this is what I told you, sig figs are like the bane of everyone's existence. It's just like these two different rules, because there's not one rule, there's two rules, and the two rules are different, and they just crush you.
How did you know so quick, though? Something tipped you off to know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What tipped me off was I went through and I said, I looked at this, and I said, all right, I got 2 sig figs in here, but this number, because I'm having it, this is going to be about 100 times 10. So 100 times 10 is going to be 1,000, and 2 sig figs at 1,000. I was just kind of eyeballing what that is. Then I looked at this one and I said, oh, this is 200 times almost 100 and 3 sig figs. So I was thinking about the place value where that one was going to be. And I just kept going through this and looking to see which one was the biggest. 200 times 540 was my biggest with 3 sig figs. I knew I was going to be up in the thousands position, and I knew I was going to be rounding close to the thousands. Just off of this one. So I was kind of walking through which is the biggest number that has the least uncertainty.
Well, we should always check.
Should always check. Gotcha. Yes, I was going through my mental Rolodex and my mental math of just eyeballing it. And that's what when I go back and I do a check, that's kind of what I do is I look at it and I say, all right, look, this thing is going to be about 1,000. 200 times a half times 10, that's going to be 100 times 10, which is 1,000. So this is going to be about 1,000. This one here is going to be 200 times 100. So right there, I've got a lot of energy in that one. That's going to be 20,000. It's in that one. This one, I have a harder time doing in my head, but that one's going to be close to 20,000. This one, I definitely have a hard time doing it in my head, but 5 times 2 is 10 with 4 zeros. So 10 with 4 zeros. So that's 100,000. I'm in the 100,000 range there. And then this one again is close to 1,000. So I'm just sort of eyeballing them together and figuring out how they add together in my head. Mental math helps. Just to check. All right. We lost Vanessa. Vanessa, that was the problem.
I'm still here.
You're still there. That was the problem that we wanted to do to show you the different components that we were adding up these five different components.
Yeah, that helped a lot. What confused me, I think, with the last problem is that 100 degrees Celsius is technically still boiling, right?
Yes.
So there's no steam happening yet, so I think I was confused by that. But this helped so much. Thank you.
Good. Excellent. Okay. So, and as always, a little color coding that each one of these is different in terms of what it is that I'm calculating here. And seeing these as being parts that are adding up. And the different parts of the calculation. And those are the five different pieces that we're adding together. Okay, cool.
Wait,
that
question.
Yes.
Can you go back up to that picture?
The one I was just coloring in?
Yes. So you said five. One, two, so there's five pieces colored in, but what about that little white thing?
That little white thing is not part because that's below 10 degrees.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So basically color coding, what I've picked up. Let's make this easier on me. Color coding what I picked up is this first piece and then this guy. What are I going to do next, blue? I picked up this guy. And the last one.
And why does the part below negative 10 degrees not count?
Because what I specified was from minus 10.
I see. Okay.
On up to 110. They were specified in the problem.
Sweet. Thank you. So
that was my starting point and my ending point.
Okay.
I think that these problems are way easier if you take the word problem and create the visual of what you're trying to do. If you can see it on the graph and you plot your temperature, and then you can just sort of go through each of your points that need to happen, you can construct your equation way easier. Don't try to do these by just taking it and jumping to the formula. Take the time and draw it out. See where it is you're going. Make it a visual problem. That is always my, if I could like transmit any one best practice, take word problems, convert them into a tangible visual before you start to try to attack it. It makes it so much easier. You just have to be able to see it. Okay. That's as much as I want to do with phase changes and energy. I don't have a whole lot else that I want to do in there. There's a lot of other things that we can do with energy, and there's energy of equations, and there's all kinds of things. You'll have plenty of time for that in Chem 1A, and they'll go through it all. It's not like you need to know it. They start from the foundation anyway. We're just really trying to give you guys a foundation to build on. So that means that I want to jump from there to the last chapter and start talking about acid base and equilibrium. And so we can do a little bit here. I'm trying to see if I had notes that I wanted to use, and I do, but they're over here hiding from me. So let me think about what I want to go into real quick. Come on, notes. Usually I don't work from notes. Try not to, but sometimes it's nice to have an outline so that my thought process is a little more linear. All right, we talked about strong acids and we talked about weak acids, right? You guys remember that? You remember what makes the difference between a strong acid and a weak acid?
No. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Honesty's good. So let's define this out. This is now chapter, the next one, 14 and 13. They're kind of tagging them together. So we're going to combine chapter 13 and 14 because we're going to look at chapter 13, which is equilibrium. And chapter 14, which is acid and base, but they are really tied together. And I don't want to do a full equilibrium, and I don't even want to do a full acid base. I just want to catch some of these topics together as they relate together. When we talked about a strong acid and a strong base, our definition of a strong acid was something that dissociates completely. And a weak acid was something that dissociates a little. The degree to which something dissociates, when we look at it, one of the ways that we drew this was to say something like HA plus water goes to form A minus plus H3O plus. And that this arrow, being a one-way arrow, meant that when I looked at sort of a concentration or equilibrium sense, that almost all of the mass was on the right-hand side of the equation and just a little bit of mass was on the left-hand side of the equation. That's the way that we kind of drew that. And the difference between that and a weak acid, while the equation looks the same, the equation doesn't look any different. What we find is that the arrows that we use are different. And the arrows represent that this equation does not go to completion and that dissociates only a little. So that what we're really highlighting here is a one-way arrow versus a two-way arrow. What does that mean?
I thought the mass always stayed the same because of the law of conservation.
The mass, oh, yes, I'm trying to figure out how I want to answer that. In an equation, Jeremy, in an equation, when the reaction goes to 100% completion, the mass that we started with on the left must be the same as the mass on the right. However, when we have a reaction that does not go to completion, the mass that I start with on the left must be equal to the mass remaining on the left plus the mass on the right. In other words, if I took everything that I started with, let's say that I started with this much material. And in here, I'm going to say that there's two little boxes that this little box is that little guy. And the rest of this box is this guy. This was my starting point, how much I started with of HA and water. Initial. If that's how much I started with, then what I end with has to be the same. And it is when I take the two parts and add them together. So that the mass for the overall equation has to be equal. In other words, the mass that's over here, the equation must be balanced. So I must show the same amount of mass on the left-hand side and the right-hand side. But when I look and see what the system does, the system, the equilibrium, and that's what this is called, is the equilibrium, has all of the mass that went into the problem and how it's been distributed between the reactants and the products. Equilibrium, every chemical reaction has an equilibrium state. That state can be very different from chemical reaction to chemical reaction. And yes, this has nothing to do with pH. Not yet. It will, but not yet. When I look at equilibrium, is based on an equation that we call the It'll come back to me in a second. A plus B goes to make, that was supposed to be B. B goes to make C plus D. Equilibrium is based on what's called the reaction quotient. It's a way of mathematically writing, we call it Q, reaction quotient, which is equal to the concentration of C raised to the power of C times the concentration of D raised to the power of D divided by the concentration of A raised to A and the concentration of B raised to B, where A and B, the lower cases, are coefficients. The upper cases are the chemical elements measured in moles per liter. So these are the chemical species, is another way to say it. So that this symbol of square brackets around A equals moles per liter A. It's a way of saying concentration. This quotient, this mathematical statement of a chemical formula, can be measured at any point in a chemical reaction. We can measure it at the beginning of a reaction, we can measure it at the middle of a reaction, we can measure it at the end of the reaction. At the end of the reaction, the reaction comes into what is called equilibrium. Equilibrium is a state. Equilibrium equals when the forward reaction and the reverse reaction have the same rate. That means that I'm forming products and reactants at the same rate. So visually, forwards and reverse are equal. Rate forward equals rate reverse. This is what we call the state of equilibrium or dynamic equilibrium. Sometimes they throw the word in there, dynamic equilibrium. Every chemical reaction at its termination reaches a point of equilibrium, but that equilibrium point does not necessarily mean that it has all gone to products. The equilibrium point is where we measure what we call at equilibrium. So if we're looking at Q at equilibrium, this is where my concentrations, do I still have it here? Yeah. C D A and B. Basically, it's the products over reactants. These are now all at equilibrium concentrations where the rates are the same. So we're now saying all at equilibrium, this equals K, which is the equilibrium constant. Okay, now this part is a little bit tricky, so stay with me. Q is the quotient, the reaction quotient. It can be measured at any point in the reaction. When I measure Q at equilibrium, Q at equilibrium equals K, the equilibrium constant. So K is a special value of Q that happens at equilibrium. K is a special value of Q that happens at equilibrium. Let's think about what K actually means. What does K tell us? K can be, this is a fraction, right? So this fraction, if I look at a chemical reaction, and let's take three different chemical reactions and their K values as measured. So the reaction is A plus B goes to make C. Plus D. And I know I'm doing this abstractly, and we'll put numbers to it later, but abstractly, this is what we need to do. And we write products over reactants. This value, which equals K, if K is greater than 1. What does it actually mean if K is greater than 1? It means that the numerator is bigger than the denominator. I think of it this way. I think of it as these guys being really big. And the denominator being really small. What that means is that in equilibrium, the products vastly outnumber the reactants. What does it mean if K is equal to 1? What would you think that that would mean in a fractional sense?
Equilibrium?
They're all equilibrium.
Oh.
But you wanted to use the word equal. Give Vanessa one more chance here to finish that out. You wanted to use the word.
Yeah, like there's no like off balance. Like it's
equal. That means that they're equal, but not equilibrium. So they're equal in their amounts, but they're all at equilibrium. This is equilibrium because the forward and the reaction rate are equal. If K is equal to 1, the amount of mass on both sides are equal and the rate forward and reverse are equal. So what we have is we have the products and reactants are in about equal concentrations. C, and D, and A, and B are all about the same. And visually, what I say is that I have about the same amount of mass on both sides, reactants and products. And if K is less than one, then what happens is the denominator is overwhelming. This needs to move down to the next page because it's just too tight here. If K is less than one, then what's happening here with K less than one is that the situation is now such that my denominator has increased and I have A and B, which are large, but my numerator, the C and D are tiny. And my equilibrium looks like this. It is skewed towards my products.
Could you clarify the forwards and backwards rate again?
The forwards and backwards rate is at equilibrium, the forwards and the reverse rate are the same. At equilibrium, what we're saying is regardless of any one of these situations, regardless of whether there are more products, equal products and reactants, or more products, more reactants, where did that come from? That was supposed to be, I wrote them in reverse. Regardless of which situation we're in, the forwards and reverse rates are the same at equilibrium. So for all of these, I could add one more additional piece of information that says that the forward rate and the reverse rate are equal and that it's stuck in these positions and can't move beyond these positions. What is forward rate? What is reverse rate? It is the rate at which a reaction is proceeding. It is the rate at which products are being made and the rate at which reactants are being consumed. They are the forwards and the reverse rate. If I look at a forwards rate of a chemical reaction, a rate, forwards, is measured in, can be measured in many different units. And so we don't generally put units to it because of that reason. The rate forward is the rate at which reactants are being converted to products over a unit time. You can think of it as a unit time. Per unit time, how fast, speed, exactly. And the rate reverse, is the rate at which products are being converted back into reactants. Equilibrium is where those two rates are equal. So I'm running a little bit over time. Let me give you an example that's not a chemical reaction, but demonstrates equilibrium, okay? I can think of two quick examples for you to maybe set this process. Let's think about a container of water. And this water is evaporating. So we've got, that is not working for me. That's so much easier. So we've got a container of water that's evaporating. And as this container of water evaporates, water is going into the gas phase. And we've got water down here that's in the liquid phase. If I let this go over time, the evaporation will continue until such time as the water is almost entirely gone. Eventually, the water will come down to nothing. And the reason that that's happening is because the rate of evaporation, the forward rate, is much greater than the rate of condensation. And that happens because as this goes up into the gas phase, it can distribute and move away from the container, making it very unlikely for water molecules to come back and recondense back into a liquid. But if I take that same picture and all I do is change one little thing, the one thing that I change is I put a lid on it. If I put a tight lid on it, then after, I don't care how long, X amount of time, what winds up happening is I don't get evaporation like this. I get that same picture. But what's happening? What's happening is molecules didn't stop evaporating. Molecules have been evaporating this entire time. Molecules have been evaporating and condensing at the same rate. And a water molecule that is in the air condenses into a liquid, and liquid evaporates into gas, and they're happening simultaneously. For every water molecule that settles down and becomes a liquid, another one pops off and becomes a gas, and the ratio of gas to liquid remains the same as long as the temperature remains the same. And this is dynamic equilibrium. So this is the rate of evaporation and the rate of condensation become the same. And because they're the same, that is equilibrium.
But if the temperature changes, then the rate
equilibrium
changes, right?
Changes.
Oh, the equilibrium changes?
Yeah, the equilibrium changes. The rate doesn't change, the equilibrium changes. Well, actually, the rate initially changes. Those are great questions. Oh, we got some great questions coming up. We're going to have a lot of fun with this as we come back and talk about this a little bit more. But what happens is, let's say we increase the temperature. Initially, what happens is the rate of evaporation increases. As the rate of evaporation increases, more gas gets in here. But the dynamic equilibrium gets thrown out of whack. The rate constant holds. And so what winds up happening is everything adjusts and the rate of condensation increases again. And it goes back into dynamic equilibrium. Essentially, what we get into is what's called the Chatelier's principle. When you stress an equilibrium, the equilibrium will always return because the equilibrium is a physical constant that the universe sets. The K value is a constant which is temperature dependent, but set by the universe. Stress the K value, it goes to Q, and then it goes right back to K. And so the equilibrium reestablishes. So if I take a chemical reaction and I throw more reactants at it, it actually shifts to produce more products to reestablish the equilibrium. The universe says, wait, no, you broke the law. You can't do that. You messed up my K, and I'm just going to put K right back. And so it readjusts the concentration of all the other factors to make Q back equal to K again, and the equilibrium reestablishes.
So when you look at K is bigger than one, that can kind of be like that, like the temperature increases, so the steam increases, but ultimately the equilibrium.
If we think about this water sort of example, if we think about the water example as there is much more mass in the water than there is in the gas, and we say that these are the reactants and those are the products, then yes, we could say K is sort of greater than one in that instance. And we're gonna have a bunch of examples. We're gonna draw out a bunch of examples and we'll look at K values. We'll look at what it means in terms of equilibrium. And then we'll see how it means in terms of acid base. And we'll do just a scooch more on acid base. And then we'll close it out and we'll be done. But we got a bunch of great questions and a bunch of great examples to come up with equilibrium. These are fun topics to talk about, for sure. Okay, Kai's out of here. He's got to get to work. I'm sure the rest of you want to eat lunch. I'd like to eat lunch.
What does tomorrow look like again? Same as usual?
Same as usual. We'll do the same thing. Okay. Cool. And then I'll get the test up for you guys and we'll have it up there. We'll do office hours. I'll try and make myself available over the weekend at some point too, so that you guys can get on me email pretty easily. If I need to, maybe I'll be on the computer at some point and let people know. I don't know. Depends on what people need or what they want. And think about all the questions that you want to ask tomorrow in terms of equilibrium, what we've generated today. Write them down so you don't forget them. Any assignments due? Eric's asking me about assignments due. Eric, I don't have any immediately that are due other than the things that have already been posted. I've just been putting up some homework assignments for you guys to work on and the suggested ones, yeah. And we're doing those in lab. So we're working on those together in lab, but they give you additional practice if you want to go back and practice them on your own. And as always, everybody is still invited to lab. So if you want to show up for the afternoon lab, you're more than welcome to get some more practice in.
Thank you.
Okay. When is the date of the final?
I'm going to post the final or try to post the final for tomorrow, but the final is going to be due like on Sunday. And try and give you guys a couple of days to work on it. And you'll get two attempts. For the parts that are in Canvas that I can program in Canvas, I'll give you two attempts. For any of those things that need to be uploaded, there's nothing I can do there for multiple attempts. But those are things that are like the Lewis structures and electronic configurations, things that can't be programmed into Canvas. We'll do a manual submission for any of those type components.
Sounds good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Remember how you said in that email that you would make everything clear today?
Yes, I did say that, but we haven't talked about your things yet today.
No, I know. But would that clarification come via email or are we going to do it?
Yeah, I guess I need to send you another email or you can jump into office hours.
I can't, I have to work.
I'll send you an email.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, you guys. Let's jump out of here. I'll see the rest of you in the afternoon. We're showing up in lab. And otherwise, I'll see you tomorrow.